Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At ChumbaCasino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
This is Kid in a Cage.
Florida versus Timothy Ferriter.
A father accused of locking his adopted son inside a cage. Join us as we hear the facts behind these charges
through live courtroom audio from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Matter of State versus Ferriter.
Morning, Judge. Coram Wahid and Priya Murad for Mr. Ferriter is present.
All right, let me have appearances, please.
On behalf of the state, Your Honor, Brianna Coakley and Karen Black.
All right, we are here for the third day of trial with opening statements slated to begin this morning. Anything I need to address before we get started?
Yes, the defense has provided me a video they intend to play an opening statement. The state objects to it. And it's a five-minute video that includes a lot of photographs that the state montages, videos that the state doesn't believe will come into evidence. They're not relevant. They're prejudicial. And so we would object to them being shown to the jury at this time prior to Your Honor making an evidentiary ruling.
All right.
I can show it to the court.
What's the basis, and how does it not amount to just good character-type evidence?
So, Judge,
that's the primary concern I have after coming out of the hearing yesterday when you told me that you had 200 photos.
I understand that, Your Honor, but this video is only 5 minutes. I would say the second half of it includes ring videos that were disclosed by the state in discovery. So the beginning of the video includes some family photos and videos, and the reason it doesn't amount to good character evidence is There's an intent element here.
I understand that, but it doesn't mean you can put in evidence of good character to negate an intent element of a criminal offense. So,
Judge, it is kind of different here because the issue is parenting, right? And they're trying to say that there's a time frame in which, and they're going to show limited videos of the relationship between parents and children that say this is abusive because of the way in which that this particular conduct. Okay,
where's your client?
I think Mr. Wahid is getting him, Judge.
All right, we should have him present for this argument.
Mr. Ferriter's
all right, so court knows that Mr. Ferriter is now present. All right, so go ahead, Ms. Moran.
So, Judge, it's a short video. I don't believe that it's cumulative. I'm happy to show it to the court. It's primarily things from after Ronan was 10 years old. And it's only for opening. And again, I would ask the court to consider that the second half of it is just ring videos that are disclosed in discovery. So the fact that the state is able to play videos of him in a room or doing things that they deem abusive, the only way for us to counter that is to offer context as to what the rest of his life was like. Otherwise, it's just them yelling at him or putting him in a room. Right? Like any parent, if anyone's worst parenting hits were recorded on video, I think everyone would seem abusive. So we have to be able to offer some level of context. I understand that the court can sort of tailor that so that it's not cumulative.
The most pious individual in the world could be a great, upstanding, moral individual, but if that individual, despite his piety or great character, commits a single act that results in a criminal offense, my understanding of the law is that evidence of piety and great character doesn't come in to negate the criminal offense that has occurred. So how is this different from that?
Because that piety is irrelevant to, if someone shoots somebody and murders them, the fact that they served food at the food bank is irrelevant. In this case, we are being asked to make, or the jury is being asked to make a decision about whether or not a parent had the intent to commit abuse and whether or not that abuse was already committed. So it's not just good character evidence. It ties into the facts because this relationship is relevant. It's like,
so let me give you some context, and I'll give you an opportunity to make your argument. Let's say you want to show pictures. I haven't seen them yet. But you want to show pictures of the defendant and his son, him taking his son to a basketball game or soccer game, him playing catch with his son, doing father-son types of things. How is that relevant to the issue of whether he's guilty or has committed the criminal offenses of which he's alleged to have committed in this case?
Because as the jury said yesterday during our discussion of criminal intent, if Mr. Farriter does not testify, right, the only way to determine his intent is his conduct. And if the only person that's permitted to admit conduct is the state, then we have no ability to negate what that intent is and show, no, this is a family with ups and downs, and there were issues that this child was facing. But that doesn't mean he was unloved or uncared for.
But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. How does it matter? It doesn't matter whether he's loved or unloved. If the criminal offense is false, let's deal with false imprisonment, for instance. If the criminal offense is false imprisonment, and the allegations are that he placed his son in improper confinement that amounted to alleged false imprisonment. It doesn't matter whether he loved his son or not. That's irrelevant. It's, did he stick his son in a facility or structure that amounts to, under the law, false imprisonment? That's the issue, isn't it?
So I think that's different for the false imprisonment charge than it is the aggravated and the neglect. So the false imprisonment charge is sort of a different, I mean, I still think there's an intent element there, but I understand why there's a little bit more clarity as to what constitutes false imprisonment. But what constitutes child abuse is different, because there's a lot of stuff that parents are allowed to do that does not constitute child abuse, unlike false imprisonment, where there's a lot more clarity. And there is a maliciousness element. The state spent an extensive amount of time talking to the jury about what does maliciousness mean to you. If all they see are the state's videos, that's what they're going to think.
Right.
I would like the court to view the video. It's 5 minutes. I need to put it in the record anyway. And if the court is not inclined to permit me to play any of it, I would ask that the court permit me to play the videos that were disclosed in discovery by the state during the course of time.
Disclosed in discovery is not the barometer or the measure by which you're allowed to present it to the jury. There's a lot of stuff disclosed during discovery that is not admissible at the trial. So let me make this simple. If there are things in this video that are not coming into evidence at trial, I'm not going to allow you to show it.
But
do you believe you're going to be able to overcome the objection? Because I assume there's going to be an objection to these things coming into trial. And if you're going to show them evidence that I know that's not going to come in during the trial, I'm not going to allow it in opening statements.
Based on the argument that I'm presenting to the court, is that it should be admitted. And so I think the court needs to view it and make a pretrial ruling. And I know that delays the jury. We could either do it now or bring the jury, do the instruction, state do their opening, and then give them a short break, because I know they've been waiting. It's a five-minute video. I'm happy to email it to Your Honor's judicial assistant so the court can even watch it in the back. And then perhaps there are portions of the video that the court would allow. Because I understand what the court is saying, that just because, of course, something's in discovery, we depose on all sorts of stuff and it's speculative, it doesn't come into evidence. However, in this particular situation, there's a 4-week time period, that's it, within which the state is saying that certain conduct happened that amounts to aggravated child abuse, child neglect, and false imprisonment. And so there are other videos during the course of that show that there is no malicious intent. So if we do not have the ability within reason, and I understand if the court makes a ruling that too much of it is cumulative, but if we don't have any shot at explaining, then
back to my hypothetical example. Your client takes his son to the basketball game on a Saturday afternoon. Great day. They're laughing, smiling, having a great old time. Brings him back home and puts him in, allegedly, in this structure, locks the key from the outside. I'm concerned that you're kind of going down a path of saying that taking the child to the game and doing the father-son thing somehow justifies or explains putting the son allegedly in the cage, and that I can't connect those dots.
No, Judge, that's not the defense.
All right, so what is the relevancy of it then?
I think that the issue is the court's understanding of the room and how it was utilized. So first and foremost, you know, the defense's position is that it was utilized primarily for supervision. In his own deposition, Ronan said it wasn't locked all the time. This is mainly in the evenings when he couldn't be supervised. And we're still working on putting it all together, but that will be presented in the defense case in chief based on the videos provided in discovery, and I do think that's relevant. So how can a jury make a determination about the relationship between a parent and a child without some context as to what the relation? It's like a self-defense case. You have to have context in order to explain conduct.
And they got to do it based on admissible evidence. If there's not admissible evidence, then they may not be able to make that connection. But it still boils down to both sides having to work with what is admissible in this case. And that's my job as the judge, to ensure that what comes in is admissible and what's presented to them is admissible. And I have significant concerns that what may be in this video is not admissible. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to spend any more time on this. Email it to my chambers right now. I'll review it, and then I'll come back out and announce a ruling. So the court's going to be in recess for 10 minutes for me to review this video.
Mr. Wahid, he has an argument to add.
I just want to add one thing, Judge. First.
All right, so let me make sure that we have a proper protocol here going forward. One spokesman per side per issue. So if you take the lead, Ms. Murad, I'm only going to hear from you. I have no problem with Mr. Wahid taking the lead, and I'll hear only from him. But I don't want to have this double teaming, and so you know my procedure. I will go ahead and hear your comment at this point, because I didn't advise you of that prior to this instance. But going forward, I'm only going to hear from one side, one spokesman for each issue. So that means you can alternate whatever issues you want to discuss. All right, go ahead, Mr. Wahid.
Thank you, Judge. First, in terms of admissible evidence, you definitely have RF who's going to be able to speak to those photographs. So that evidence would be admissible at the very least through RF. So he's aware of those things. He was asked about some of those things in deposition. He admits those things. These pictures would be admissible through RF. Second, at least most of them. Second, because at some point he was too young. So obviously the ones where he's too young, he won't recall. Second, our defense, which is the affirmative parental defense, there's an issue of reasonableness, of reasonable parenting. And that requires context. It requires the jury to understand. And just for the court's information, what's going to come out through both a state expert and a defense expert is the escalating history of the family dealing with RF and his mental health issues throughout the course of his life. And it is important because the state is essentially putting forth that he is in this room all of the time, or the majority of the time when he's not in school. And that has to be rebutted. This evidence rebuts that.
I'm not sure I agree with you. I haven't said yet that I would knock out photos of perhaps the parents and RF going to a psychiatrist office, for instance, or going to a mental health facility. But that would be something that might be admissible, and it might be relevant to the response and the efforts of the parents to deal with the issues that they're having with their child. I get that. I get the strategy. But just simply showing a picture of the parents and the children having a good time at some point, to me, is not relevant to the specific issues that I have to decide in this case from an evidentiary standpoint. I'm not going to hear any further argument. Go ahead and email it to my chambers, and I will take a recess for 10 minutes. When I come back, I'll announce a ruling. All right, court's in recess.
Court's in brief recess.
Everyone may be seated. All right, after reviewing the video of the proposed video of the defense in camera, court sustains the objection of the state. All right, anything else I need to address prior to the opening statements? Okay, all sides ready to proceed? Why don't we go ahead and get the jury started, and we can do that maybe after they break for lunch and take a few minutes at that time.
Sounds good.
Okay. All right, go ahead and bring them out. All right.
So.
All right, everyone may be seated. All right, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, welcome back. Trust everyone had a good evening. I apologize for the later than anticipated start, but I can assure you that while you've been in the jury room, we've been out here attending to matters that have to be handled outside of your presence. So just because you're sitting back there doesn't mean that we're not working out here to keep the case moving forward. So with all that being said, I do like to start as close to what I tell you as possible, but this morning it just wasn't feasible because of issues I had to deal with. I do have about 10 to 15 minutes of instructions to read to you before we start with opening statements. As with all the instructions that I will be reading to you during these proceedings, I ask that you give them your very close attention. You will be provided with a copy of the instructions prior to going into the jury room for deliberation, so you don't have to memorize anything that I'm telling you because you'll have it in writing. Okay, so we'll begin without further ado. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you have been selected and sworn as the jury to try the case of the state of Florida versus Timothy Dunn Ferreter. This is a criminal case. Timothy Dunn Ferreter is charged with aggravated child abuse and false imprisonment and neglect of a child. The definition of aggravated child abuse, false imprisonment, and neglect of a child will be explained to you later. The state's charging document, which is called an information, is not evidence and is not to be considered by you as any proof of guilt. It is the judge's responsibility to explain the law to you. It is your solemn responsibility to determine if the state proved its accusation beyond a reasonable doubt against Timothy Dunn Ferreter in accordance with the law that I will provide to you during these proceedings. Thus, the province of the jury and the province of the court are well defined and they do not overlap. This is one of the fundamental principles of our system of justice. Before proceeding further, it will be helpful for you to understand how a trial is conducted. At the beginning of the trial, the attorneys will have an opportunity, if they wish, to make what is called an opening statement. The opening statement gives the attorneys a chance to tell you what they believe the evidence will be that will be presented during the trial. What the lawyers say, however, is not evidence, and you're not to consider it as such. Following the opening statements, witnesses will be called to testify under oath. They will be examined and cross-examined by the attorneys. And documents and other exhibits may also be produced as evidence during the proceedings. After the evidence has been presented, the court will then give you the instructions on the law. The attorneys at that time will then have the opportunity to make what are called their closing arguments. Following the closing arguments by the attorneys, the court will then conclude with the final instructions to you. After the final instructions are given, and only then will you then retire to consider your verdict. You should not form any definite or fixed opinions on the merit of this case until you've heard all of the evidence, the argument of the lawyers, and the instructions on the law that will be provided to you by me at the appropriate time. Until that time, you should not discuss the case amongst yourselves and obviously with anyone else. Your verdict must be based solely on the evidence or lack of evidence in the law. I now instruct you not to communicate with anyone, including your fellow jurors, about this case. No communication, as you know already, includes no emailing, text messaging, tweeting, blogging, or any other form of communication that you can imagine in this day and age of high technology. You cannot do any research about the case or look up any information about the case or the people or places involved. If you do become aware of any violation of any of the rules that I've given you, please notify court personnel of the violation, and that court personnel would be my bailiff, whom I introduced to you during the first day of trial. During the course of the trial, the court may take recesses, and at that time, you'll be permitted to separate and go about your own personal affairs. During these recesses, however, you must not discuss the case with anyone, nor permit anyone to say anything to you or in your presence about the case. If anyone attempts to say anything to you or in your presence, please ask that person to stop and advise them that you're on the jury trying the case. If he or she persists, leave that person at once and immediately report the matter to my courtroom deputy, who will then advise me. All cell phones, computers, tablets, or other types of electronic devices must be turned off while you're in the courtroom, and that includes not putting them on vibrate. When we're in the trial, I ask my jurors to have your phones completely off because I want you to be focused on the evidence and not be distracted by vibrating either your phone or anybody else's. So I do ask that you turn them off completely. And as I said, turned off means that the phone or other electronic device is actually off and not in the silent or vibrating mode. So what that means is if you do need to have someone be able to reach you in case of emergency, my bailiff can give you the number that they can call and any message will get to me very promptly. You may use your devices during the recesses, but even then you may not use your cell phone or other electronic device to find out any information about the case or communicate with anyone about the case or, again, the people and places involved. Do not take photographs, video recordings, or audio recordings of the proceedings or of your fellow jurors. After each recess, please double-check to make sure that your cell phone or other electronic device is turned off, as I've explained. At the end of the case, while you are deliberating, you must not communicate with anyone outside of the jury room. And what that means is you cannot have in the jury room any cell phones, computers, or other electronic devices. And if someone needs to contact you in an emergency, as I just said, the court can give messages and deliver them to you without delay. And that contact number will be provided to you by Mark if you need it. So once you go into deliberate, you'll actually give your phone to my courtroom deputy who will guard it during the time period that you're deliberating. Remember, the case must be tried by you only on the evidence presented during the trial in your presence and in the presence of the defendant, the attorneys, and the judge. Jurors must not conduct any investigation of their own, and this includes reading newspapers, watching television, or using a computer, cell phone, the internet, any electronic device, or any other means at all to get information related to the case or the people and places involved in this case. And again, this applies whether you're in the courthouse, at home, or anywhere else. You must not visit places mentioned in the trial or use the internet to look at maps or pictures to see any place discussed during the trial. Jurors must not have discussions of any sort with friends or family members about the case or the people and places involved. So, as I've already mentioned this to you before, do not let even your closest family members make comments to you or ask questions about the trial. In this age of electronic communication, I want to stress again that you must not talk about this case face-to-face. You must not talk about this case by using any electronic device, and you must not use phones, computers, or other electronic devices to communicate in any way regarding this case. So do not send or accept any messages related to this case or your jury service. Do not discuss this case or ask for advice by any means at all, including posting information on an internet website, chat room, or blog. And let me digress for just a moment. The most often violated, or the violation that occurs with respect to this rule is someone will innocently get on Facebook, post a picture of themselves and say, I'm on this trial for the next week, and this is what the case is about. That would be a violation of this, the rule. So stay away from social media at all costs during this week, and don't post or do anything regarding what you're doing and what type of case you're involved in. So what are the reasons for these rules? Because they're pretty strict and all-encompassing. These rules are imposed because the jurors must decide the case without distraction and only on the evidence presented in the courtroom. If you investigate, research, or make inquiries on your own, I have no way to make sure that the information you obtain is proper for the case. And likewise, the parties have no opportunity to dispute or challenge the accuracy of what you may have found. And as I also advised you during the first day of this matter, doing anything outside of this courtroom would be contrary to our judicial system, which assures that every party has the right to ask questions about and challenge the evidence being considered against it, and to present argument with respect to that evidence. So any independent investigation by a juror, as you can imagine, would unfairly and improperly prevent the parties from having the opportunity that our judicial system provides to them. Also, any juror who violates these restrictions jeopardizes the fairness of these proceedings, and a mistrial could result that would require the entire trial process to start over. Mistrial is a tremendous expense and inconvenience to the parties, the court, and the taxpayers, but also to you folks, because this is your third day of contributing your time and energy to this proceedings, and if there was a mistrial, all of the time you spent up to this point would have been lost and wasted. So, again, this just underscores the importance of complying with all the rules. If you do violate these rules, as you know, you may be held in contempt of court and face sanctions such as serving time in jail, paying a fine, or both. It's rare, but it happens enough in the world that you need to know there are potential consequences if you do violate the rules. In every criminal proceeding, a defendant has the absolute right to remain silent. At no time is it the duty of a defendant to prove his innocence, and from the exercise of a defendant's right to remain silent A jury is not permitted to draw any inference of guilt, and the fact that a defendant did not take the witness stand must not influence your verdict in any manner whatsoever. We spent a lot of time going over that during the voir dire. The attorneys are trained in the rules of evidence and trial procedure, and it's their duty to make all objections that they feel are proper. When an objection is made, however, you should not speculate on the reason why it is made, and likewise, when an objection is sustained or upheld by me, you must not speculate on what might have occurred had the objection not been sustained, nor what a witness might have said had he or she been permitted to answer. During the trial, it may be necessary to confer with the attorneys out of your hearing to discuss matters that require consideration by me alone and outside of your presence. It is impossible to predict when such conferences may be required or how long they will last, but when such conferences do occur, please rest assured that they will be conducted in a manner so as to consume as little of your time as possible. And what that means is that if I can do it up here at sidebar, I'll do it and you'll hear this noise. You've heard that already. And so that means that we can conduct a conference up here and you won't hear it. If it's going to take more than just a couple minutes at any sidebar, I typically will have Mark or my bailiff escort you back to the jury room where you can be more comfortable while I'm, again, dealing with matters outside of your presence. I note that everyone looks like they have a note, pen, and pad, so let me talk a little bit about taking notes during the trial. If you would like to take notes, obviously you may do so. On the other hand, you're not required to do so, and it's your own personal choice and decision whether you do take notes or not. Everyone does have a pen and pad that has been provided to you, so you should use that for any notes that you do take. Please keep in mind that if you do take notes, that the notes will be for your own personal use, but you won't be able or permitted to take them from the courtroom. During the recesses, my bailiff will collect your notes and then pass them back out to you when you return to the jury box. After you've completed your deliberations, the court deputy will then deliver your notes to me, at which time they will be destroyed, and I can assure you that no one will read your notes, so they're for your own private purposes, for purposes of what you're doing as jurors in this case. I would tell you, though, if you do take notes, don't get so involved in the note-taking that you lose focus on what is being said from the witness stand. If those have been in college or high school, you can remember those times where some of us tried to write down each and everything the professor or teacher said, and in the process of trying to write down everything, we lost track of what was being said. We don't want that to happen in a criminal trial because it is very important for you to listen to and hear everything that's being said from the witness stand, because that testimony is the evidence by which you will be guided in your determination as to the ultimate verdict in this case. Lastly, whether you take notes or not, you should rely on your own memory of the evidence, and you should not be unduly influenced by the notes of others. And so I would say to you that notes are not entitled to any greater weight than each juror's memory of the evidence that's being presented. In just a few moments, we're going to begin opening statements, but I want to, before I do that, I just want to ask the same question that I asked at the beginning of voir dire yesterday. During the last 24 hours, has anyone that's a member of this jury been exposed to any media coverage of this case, either through any TV newscast or newspaper article, blog, email, or any other type of source? Has anyone on the jury been exposed inadvertently to any media coverage over the past 24 hours? Okay. Let the record reflect that there was no affirmative indication that anyone had been exposed to any jury coverage. All right, so at this time, the attorneys for the parties are going to have an opportunity to make their opening statements, as indicated, in which they may explain to you the issues in the case and summarize the facts that they expect the evidence will show. After all the evidence has been received, the attorneys will again have an opportunity to address you and make their final arguments. Again, the statements that the attorneys now make and the arguments that they may later make are not to be considered by you as evidence, but you should not read that as that you shouldn't pay close attention, because their opening statements are very, very important in terms of telling you what they intend to proceed with and present. So I do ask that you listen to them very carefully and give them your very close attention. At this time, is the state ready to present its opening arguments? All right, you may proceed, Ms. Coakley.
Good morning, everyone.
over the course of this week, you're going to hear a lot and get to know a lot about the life of Ronan Farriter. He goes by Ty, and today he is 16 years old. But this case starts, and really the focus of what his life was like is how his life was in end of December 2021 and January of 2022 when he was just 14 years old. This morning, you're going to learn that on January 28th, 2022, he ran away from home. He lived in Jupiter, Florida at that time with his parents, the defendant, Tim Farriter, and his mom, Tracy Farriter. You're going to hear that Ronan was adopted as a child, as a small child, a toddler age, from Vietnam, and he had lived with the Farriter since that time. He was the second of their four children. He has an older sister named Fiona, who you're also going to get to hear from at this child during this trial, a younger sister named Nola, and a much younger little brother named Pierce, who was about 3 years old when all of this happened. And in January of 2022, he was a student at Independence Middle School and 14 years old. You're gonna hear on the 28th, he ran away from home. He was reported missing to the Jupiter Police Department, and that's where this case starts. You're gonna hear from Jupiter Police Department officers who are gonna tell you that they took the report of a missing child and that he didn't come home on the next day on the 29th, and he also still was not located on the 30th. They went back to the Farriter residence to find out if there was new information. Had he come home? Was there any leads? The day he left was a Friday, still wasn't there on Saturday. And on Sunday, Detective Sharp from the Jupiter Police Department went into the Farriter home with Tracy Farriter. You're going to hear it's at that point that for the very first time he learned about how Ronan was living, about what his living situation was like at home with his parents. He's going to tell you that he was shown the house, and the first thing that stood out to him was that the child who they were looking for didn't have a place to sleep in the main house. There wasn't a bedroom for him. There weren't his items of clothes. There weren't his toys inside of the house. Instead, there was a structure, a small room box-like structure that was constructed in the garage that didn't have any windows. It had a box spring and a mattress, a bucket in the corner, and a desk. You're gonna hear that at that point, the child still wasn't found, and so Detective Sharp left and continued the investigation. And the next day, which is Monday, January 31st, Ronan shows up at his school. And there he is made secure, made safe by the Jupiter Police Department. And that's when the criminal investigation really starts, after they had the opportunity to speak to him. You're going to hear that as part of the investigation, during that initial walkthrough of the room, Detective Sharp realized that that small cell-like room had a Ring camera in the corner to observe the occupant of the room. And so as part of his investigation, he served a search warrant to the Ring Corporation to see if they had maintained any videos. And you're going to get the opportunity to see and hear that evidence that was returned from the Ring Corporation, because that Ring camera captured moment after moment of Ronan's life in that room. You're gonna hear over and over and over again that door locking and unlocking, because the evidence is going to show that that room was not a room that Ronan could come and go from as he pleased. He was locked inside from the outside over and over again. You're also going to see that he did not have the ability to control things like the lights in that room, that the only way that those lights could be controlled was outside the room. And so you're going to see him sitting in the dark in a windowless room for hours at a time. And we're not just talking from 10 p.m. till 7 o'clock in the morning overnight. You're going to see that even during the day, there are times in which his parents, the defendant and his wife, would turn off that light and leave their 14-year-old son locked in a room in the dark, alone, isolated. You're also going to get to observe and hear the anger and the derision, the physical altercations that this defendant has with his child on the Ring camera, physical intimidation and the threats of violence. You're also going to see Ronan having to use that bucket, having to pee in the bucket, because for hours overnight, he did not have access or the opportunity to go to the bathroom. And the only option for him was to pee in the bucket. And then you're going to see the next morning when that occurred, that this defendant would tell him, clean out the bucket, make sure the neighbors don't see you doing that. Because this treatment, his life, was kind of a secret thing. And you're going to hear that it's not the state's case, and it's not the evidence in this case that he was kept in there 24 hours a day. He went to school. There were times where he was outside of the room with his family. There was times where he was shoveling shells for his father for hours at a time. But for long periods of time, for mass majority of this child's life, in that period in Jupiter, Florida, he's in that room, isolated, alone, without autonomy, without privacy, without stimulation, sometimes with only a single book to read over and over again. As part of the evidence in this case, you're going to hear that the defendants are charged with that 4-week period, that 4 to 6 week period, because they moved, the family moved to Jupiter, Florida in December of 2021. Mid-December, kind of a week or two before Christmas, and this all happens at the end of January. So we're talking about 6 weeks when they are in Palm Beach County, Florida. And so that's the charged time period. That's the criminal conduct that we're talking about. But the state expects that you're going to hear evidence about Ronan's life before the family moved to Florida, when they lived in Arizona. We expect that you're going to hear testimony about a very similar, nearly identical room that the family constructed for him in Arizona, in which he had been residing in since he was 11 years old. You're going to hear that that room had no access to a bathroom, no control of the lights, no freedom of movement, that he was recorded, and that he was locked in from the outside with only a bucket to go to the bathroom. The charges in this case are aggravated child abuse, child neglect, and false imprisonment. And at the end of this trial, Judge Coates is going to read you instructions about what the law is for child abuse in the state of Florida. And you're going to hear that there's child abuse and there's aggravated child abuse. Aggravated child abuse occurs when a defendant engages in malicious punishment of a child, willful torture, or the willful caging of a child. And those are in the alternative, meaning it could be any of them. And child abuse in the state of Florida means the intentional act that causes physical or mental harm, or conduct that is likely to cause physical or mental harm. So that doesn't mean that there actually has to be harm, it's just that it's likely to cause harm, that they engaged in an act that is likely to harm a child. And to help you understand what the harm is here and how this conduct is criminal, the state is going to call a Dr. Wade Meyer. Dr. Meyer is a child psychiatrist. He's affiliated with Brown University. And he's going to tell you the impact that this kind of treatment has on a child, that it's humiliating, isolating, cruel, and malicious. He's going to tell you that it will cause harm to any child, but it will certainly cause harm. That harm could be exacerbated if that child already has a behavioral issue or has trauma. And you're going to hear about some of that in this case. It's true, and Ronan will admit, that there are times that he did not follow the rules, that he made mistakes, and that he did things that his parents punished him for. But you're going to hear that in no circumstance is this a protective punishment for any child, and in particular for a child who may have issues with trauma or a behavioral issue, that this is the worst possible thing that a parent could do. It is the exact opposite of any recommended treatment, of any therapeutic purpose, or anything that would lead to productive, a productive response from a child. Instead, Dr. Myers would tell you that it would increase the likelihood of behavioral issues. Because when you isolate a child like this, when you humiliate them, when you basically put them in solitary confinement for large portions of the day, that has a negative mental impact. At the end of this trial, Judge Coates will instruct you on the law, but I want to be very clear on a couple of things. The state here does not have to prove that every moment of its day they were committing a crime against Ronan Verriter. We don't have to prove that there are no moments when he was let out of the room. That's not the state's case, and that's not what Dr. Myers is going to say is necessary to cause harm. We also don't have to prove, and you're not going to hear, that there's any kind of legal defense or special standard for a child that has behavioral issues. That if
overruled.
The law, you're going to hear from Judge Coates. The law you're going to hear from Judge Coates is not going to be that there's any kind of affirmative defense or that there's any different standard just because a child has behavioral issues. We're here today because of the actions of Tim Verriter towards his son. They were ongoing, they were intentional, and they were criminal. And so at the end of this trial, after you have heard all of the evidence, all of the testimony and the law from Judge Coates, we're going to ask you for the only verdict that is supported by the evidence and the law. And that's a verdict of guilty as charged. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Ms. Coakley. Is defense ready for an opening? Ms. Murad, you're going to handle it? You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. It is a parent's responsibility to make tough choices. Tough choices to protect their child, tough choices to protect their other children, and tough choices to protect the community. And that is what Tim Verriter did. He was faced with an impossible situation. And he made tough choices to protect Ronan, or Ty, is what we will call him throughout this trial, from himself, from the other children in his home, and from the community. You only have to make one determination in this case, and that is whether or not Tim Verriter had the criminal intent necessary. That's it. Did he or did he not have the criminal intent? And that will be your guiding question throughout this case. This case is not about whether or not Tim Verriter made the right choice, because I will be the first to tell you, the defense will be the first to tell you that he did not. But what it is about is the difficulty of parenting, right? Because bad parenting does not make somebody a criminal. Bad parenting does not mean that a person should be charged with a crime. It makes them human. It makes them a parent who is trying to figure out, when faced with a child, as you'll hear throughout the trial, who has consistent and escalating behavioral issues, how to handle them. You will learn more throughout the trial, but I want to try in these next few minutes to share with you what that relationship looked like. In 2009, Tim Verriter and his wife Tracy took the very long flight to Vietnam to adopt their first son, Ty. At that point, him and his wife Tracy had spent some time in the Honduras, and so they were really motivated to adopt. And the first child that they adopted, Fiona, who you will hear from in this trial, is Chinese. And after they had Fiona, they were really excited to adopt again. And they wanted her to have a sibling that was culturally close to her. While they were waiting for Thai to get the news that they were going to be able to adopt from Vietnam, they had their first biological child, Nola. And within just a few years, they go from this young couple to a little family. They have three little babies. And this is really the first iteration of that family before Pierce comes along several years later. Tim and Tracy love these children.
Objection, Your Honor. Overruled.
They did everything that they could when they were young. Karate, softball, soccer. Ty was in track. He loved Legos. They got him science posters and galaxies. So he had a periodic table of elements and stuff about galaxies in his room because those were his interests. But what we don't know is how our stories will be written. We don't know where our children are going to end up. And as parents, all you can do is try to raise children who make good choices, who are going to be productive members of the community, and hope that that works. And it, unfortunately for Ronan, it just couldn't. Later in this week, you will hear from a seasoned psychologist, Dr. Sheila Rappa. Dr. Rappa is well-respected as a forensic psychologist. She's routinely hired by the state attorney's office. She is routinely court-appointed to conduct psychological evaluations in this county to give opinions about psychiatric or psychological expertise. And her specific experience is working with children like Ty. And so that's what makes her uniquely qualified to speak with you about the records that she's reviewed and the patterns of behavior that she noticed. Ty underwent a neurological examination. And what it shows, and as Dr. Rappa will explain to you, is that neuropsychological evaluation showed elevated levels of a lack of inhibition and clinically elevated levels of a lack of emotional regulation. And as Dr. Rappa will explain to you, these elevated levels are associated with early life brain development, usually when someone's a baby, pre-verbal, or even in utero. And that makes sense because Dr. Rappa reviewed records, early childhood records of Ty. And what they show is that he had malnourishment, he was not well taken care of when he was dropped off at the orphanage and while he was there. We can't know his exact medical history because his biological mother just left him at the orphanage, but the records that Dr. Rappa has reviewed over the course of Ty's life, in addition to some of the depositions taken in this case, other records, they will show you that, for very much lack of a better term, Ty is wired this way. It is a function of brain development. And it's why the ferreters continued to see patterns of behavior that would not stop. I want to take you through some of those patterns. Since he was a kid, Ronan had aggressive outbursts and tantrums.
Overruled for purposes of open.
His parents regularly received emails of him fighting at school, punching other kids, using profanity. Tim and Tracy moved Ronan. Let me start with this. He was out of school with his sister, Nola, where he pretended that a teacher asked him to make an announcement in class. So he was in a different class. He goes into Nola's class and says, "Oh, the teacher asked me to make an announcement." He has his sister stand up and humiliates her in front of the entire class, saying that she's a horrible person. And it was so disturbing to the teacher who was present, who you'll hear from throughout this trial, that she had to report it. Tim and Tracy moved Ronan to an accelerated private school in hopes that the challenging work would engage him. It was sort of a math and science type school, so they thought that that would help him stop. It did not. He stood up in class at that school and asked if the Holocaust was a good thing. He was accused of telling a student that they should get aborted. He got up in class and said that immigrants are more likely to be drug dealers. He brought a screwdriver to class and was waving it in someone's face. He stole another student's laptop, hacked into it, and looked up women getting run over by trains.
Sustained.
And he pretended to be a tutor to a friend of his.
Sustained.
And that happened while he was in
Council approach.
There's more to come.
Kid in a Cage. Florida versus Timothy Ferriter from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Press subscribe now.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.